welcome to episode 9 of Legacy Listening. I'm your host, Nancy Predahl, Lampernearson President and CEO. As an advocate for enhancing resiliency and value within our communities, my passion lies in enriching our engagement in these vital discussions. Our guest today is Brian Kaiser, Chief Technology Officer at Huddle. Brian graduated from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln with a computer engineering degree in the Jeffrey S. Raikes School in Computer Science and Management. Huddle is how the world sees sports. They have revolutionized how teams around the world capture, organize, analyze, and learn from film and data, all while fostering a company culture built on belonging and the belief that inclusive practices unlock the potential of individuals. I love that. In 2012, Brian was named to Forbes 30 Under 30 list in the sports category and was joined by co-founders David Graff and John Wirtz on Inc. Magazine's 30 Under 30 list in 2010. He is also a trustee for the University of Nebraska Foundation and on the board of Emeritus in New York. Welcome to Legacy Listening, Brian.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I'm going to ask you the first question that I ask all of our guests to kick off our episode. Lampernearson's purpose statement is leaving a legacy of enduring improvements to our community. How does our purpose of leaving a legacy resonate with you, Brian?
You know, honestly, I love that purpose. It really does speak to me both personally and professionally. I think at a personal level, what more can you leave behind than a legacy of impact? And for me and my wife, it's all about amplification. Mm. That's kind of the word that I would use. So it's one of the little things that you can do now in this short slice of life that we have that then amplify and amplify again and don't just lead to linear growth, but exponential growth of the people and the communities around you. Mm-hmm. And that's how we've tried to build Huddle in the same philosophy. So our vision statement for the company is giving every athlete the shot they deserve. Mm. And so it's how can we, you know, we're not doing the job for coaches or athletes. They have to do that themselves. Mm-hmm. But how can we give them that shot and that potential and have Huddle be that amplifier of sports and use that as a way to positively impact society? Because we do truly believe that when we talk about our mission and vision statement is that we can have a positive impact on society and amplify it through sports. So it actually really resonates with me. And I hope and I think that personally and professionally we'll be leaving a legacy behind at Huddle and myself.
Yeah, that's amazing. You started this in college.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's funny. My co-founders like to give me a little grief because I'm the only one to not have an MBA. they like to say I'm a little slow. I was in computer engineering, and as we know, engineering sometimes takes a little bit longer.
Yes.
So I had about an extra semester of work, and they all graduated with their business degrees before that. But while that journey was going on, I started my MBA classes, and they were a little deeper into them. Mm-hmm. We were able to start Huddle right at that inflection point, and kind of the cool benefit that we had, still being me a student in undergrad as we went through, is I was able to compete in business plan competitions.
Oh, very cool.
And so we actually funded the first year of the company through business plan competition winnings. I think we ended up winning around $70,000 in a year just traveling the country doing these competitions. And that allowed us to get a really small little office space, had no heat or air conditioning. So I was literally coding in gloves in the wintertime, but allowed us to bring on some interns and actually kind of incubate the company and and develop and build it at a pace that we wanted to build it at and not be, you know, pressured or forced by kind of outside financial constraints. So it really was kind of the incubation happened in the university in partnership with the athletic department with funding from business plan competition. So that kind of academic step was a big part of our journey.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool story. That's amazing. And then you didn't, as you said, you didn't have the pressure of venture capital trying to drive your mission. You were able to set your own.
It was an amazing part, and we were so fortunate. We were able to kind of bridge ourselves until we had our first paying customer in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And so then when we went out and needed some seed funding, we were able to look at investors and say, hey, we've proven this. We have a product. We have a customer using it. They're a world-class customer. Here's the testimonials. And allowed us to have a lot more kind of friendly relationship with early investors and align on where we're headed and what we're doing and feel like we had partners rather than people that just wanted a quick exit.
Yeah.
And most of those investors are still with the company 18 years later.
That's amazing.
Which shows that the kind of perspective they have for building a long-lasting company.
That's great. So the Huddle is a dynamic sports technology company that specializes in providing software solutions for athletes, coaches, and teams. Founded in 2006, as you were describing, a pretty cool story, The company has since become a leader in sports industry, offering a range of products designed to enhance performance analysis, athlete development, and team collaboration. With a diverse clientele spanning various sports disciplines worldwide, Huddle's innovative platforms have revolutionized how coaches and athletes approach training, strategy, and performance evaluation. Given its impressive growth and impact, I have to ask, what specific features or innovations set Huddle apart from other sports technology companies in the market?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd like to think I'm a little maybe appropriately biased on this one, since it's our company, but I think it is our mindset towards working with our coaches and athletes. We really do see ourselves as a partner to them, something that amplifies their ability rather than, you know, replacing it or thinking about cutting things out. And we look at it as a broad platform. A lot of companies come into the sports tech space and they say, you know, we're going to build something for NBA teams in basketball, or we're going to build something for, you know, the sports betting market in this sport vertical. Our mindset at Huddle is we want to build something for every athlete, every coach, every analyst. And I think that gives us a much longer and broader perspective. And what it means is it means we've been around for 18 years. So we've been around for a while, and it's a long, slow journey, but we feel like it's a much more stable one, allows us to have that breadth and really address the fundamentals of sport and sport analytic across industry, across geography, and across sports. And so I think that's given us that kind of staying power and then the ability to keep growing into new venues and new opportunities within the space.
Do you have a specific age group that uses the platform, or is it across the board?
That's kind of one of our strengths, I think, is we are across the board. It's the same platform. We have kids that are 12 years old using Huddle, and we have, you know, every professional athlete in the English Premier League uses us. Okay. So we get literally the highest of the high, and low sounds derogatory. I don't mean low, but the youngest of the young.
There
how about
you
that?
Yeah.
And so it really is trying to build that platform vision across every level of sport from start to finish of your career. And one of the things that's really satisfying for me is seeing athletes now that we've been around for 18 years that have made that whole journey. So you can go back and you can look at recent NFL draft picks and you can find their youth football film, their middle school film, their high school film, their college film, and soon to be their NFL film all on Huddle.
Oh, wow, that's
and
cool.
All their analysis, their entire journey is there on the platform.
Yeah. I have grandsons in Germany. My son lives in Germany with his wife, and they're in Berlin, and they're 7 and 8, and they're already getting scouted. So it starts very young.
It's incredible.
By the professional teams in Berlin. And so it's just this, it's a thing. This is a real path for children, a path for coaches, as you said, and it's unbelievable to me that they're looking at kids that young.
It's incredible, but it's an opportunity into growth for the kids, but also for the teams, but it's also a business for them. And they want to build a broad and deep talent pipeline.
Right.
And so you start young and you're able to get kids, especially in Europe, into your pipeline, and you're helping them understand your system and your way of operating and your way of training. And by every year you add to that journey makes them more compatible with your system. And so that's why the academy structure in Europe is so deep and so impactful. And it's kind of hard for us as Americans to sometimes wrap our head around, because it's like, oh my gosh, they're so young. But at the same time, we've got lots of youth sports. It's just the difference is these are being driven by organizations that are a little more proactive in advancing the athleticism and the training of those kids up that chain. It's a wild journey.
Yeah, it's been interesting from an American perspective to watch this happening, and for my grandsons and my son and his family, and how they're negotiating all that. So this opportunity to, as you said, watch the growth from middle school, grade school, up until professional leagues is pretty amazing.
It's wild. Yeah, it really is. It's cool, though.
One of the things that we loved about your company, and just doing a little bit of investigation, is just your commitment to inclusion. And you stated, Brian, in your 2023 inclusion report, one of the cool things about building a business like Huddle is seeing how people from all different backgrounds bring so much value to the company. And you're touching people from all different backgrounds across the world, internationally. It's shown over and over again how understanding different perspectives and different journeys actually leads to building a better product and better outcomes for customers. So for me, by building a company that values inclusion, we're building a better product and we have better connection with our customers. So this is a two-part question. From your perspective, how does the emphasis on inclusion at Huddle contribute to building stronger connections with customers? Mm-hmm. And what benefit does that bring to the company in terms of customer satisfaction and loyalty?
Yeah, that's such an important question, and honestly just such a complicated and deep one, because I think it is kind of woven into how we operate as a company. And you know, it speaks to what we talked to previously about how we want to be broad and a platform-based company. And I think to do that effectively, you have to have a deep partnership with your customers, and you have to know your customers and truly know them. And that's one of the biggest benefits of inclusion for Huddle is, you know, we've got a middle school football player in Western Nebraska, and we might have a collegiate basketball player in, you know, New York City or downtown Detroit, and we have a kid in Germany that's playing, and we have, you know, an analyst down in Australia, and they have different backgrounds and different perspectives and different journeys. And I think by better understanding them, you are able to partner with them more effectively, mm-hmm. and you're able to build a better product and be a better advocate for them in terms of what their needs are as a customer. And so we do think a lot about having our internal workforce reflect our customers. And it's every aspect of inclusion and diversity that factors into that. Mm-hmm. And we really think that's a strong reason why we've been so successful and one of the reasons we focus so much on it. I think, you know, maybe a close second on that is the kind of journey and what that brings our employees themselves, mm-hmm. and able to, you know, bring them their whole selves to work, being able to enjoy their work, being able to feel like it's a place they can be comfortable and prosper. And I think that happy employees make good products, you know, just, you know, candidly, selfishly as a business, it's just good business. And that's why we do it. It's good for our customers. It's good for our products, and it's good for our employees. And we've seen the benefits over the years. And I think that's one of the reasons we're such strong advocates for it is I think it's the right way to run a business.
Yeah. When we think about it from the built environment, it's just if we're not in the community, we can't understand what a community really needs. Mm-hmm. And so understanding, and especially when you're working in on a project that really is community changing, that's going to be impactful, that getting that perspective from those folks that live in the community makes a huge difference. So
you have
100%
to,
yeah. really buy into your philosophy.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think and I hope that it gets, you know, reflected, and you can see areas where we're able to, you know, increase the essentially correlation between our workforce and our customers, and you see the NPS score, Net Promoter Score, go up in those areas, mm-hmm. and you see the fact that we're connecting better with our customers, mm-hmm. and so we're able to, you know, not just qualitatively look at that, but quantitatively look at it too, and yeah. I think that helps us on that journey.
Yeah, that being able to measure it is so impactful too. Mm-hmm. So you have, with your robust inclusion philosophy, your website notes that Huddle's purpose is to give every athlete the shot they deserve. You mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm. At its core, this is about inclusion in sports. It's about giving all athletes an opportunity to use their unique skills, identity, and experiences. And that you're driven by giving these teams the tools to bring out the best in their athletes. The same needs to be true within the company. I mean, you have to walk the walk.
Yeah.
You talked about that net promoter score and being yeah. able to have their community of your team at Huddle be familiar or similar to your teams that you're mm-hmm. working with. So how does Huddle actively implement its inclusion philosophy within the company culture and day-to-day operations?
Yeah, there's a number of things we do. There's not a single way to go about this, in my opinion. There's not some silver bullet that does it. And so we've had a handful of programs and initiatives we've done. One that's maybe near and dear to my heart is we did a kind of senior leadership inclusion program, and it was a year-long journey, and it was led by our internal team, and it was all about kind of walking the walk and talking the talk. Mm-hmm. So if we're not going to do that as senior leaders, how can we expect the rest of the company to do that? So we're going to start at the top, and we're going to do a deep dive and understand, you know, what makes each of us tick. We went through our backgrounds and our fears and our journeys, and really trying to understand how the diversity between us, whether it's, you know, gender or race or socioeconomic or geography, like how that's impacted our perception of ourselves and our customers mm-hmm. and our relationship with Huddle, and then get really vulnerable. So we broke into small groups to understand, you know, what are our fears about this? Mm-hmm. You know, let's not just make blanket statements. Let's understand maybe what are some internal biases that I have. And then let's just be honest and transparent and talk to each other about it and try to, like, you know, work through this and not judge people, but mm-hmm. try to get better and grow. And then how can we take that down to our teams? And it was a super, super impactful program, of takeaways. Mm-hmm. And the challenge now is, how do we scale that to the rest of the company, mm-hmm. Which is what we're working on right now. But we kind of started with leaders. Mm-hmm. I think some of the other things we do is, it's, you know, inclusion is baked into our onboarding program. It's baked into our management training. It's baked into our interview training. We kind of need to make sure we layer it into everything we're doing, because it's all these little bitty actions that then get your end result. Again, there's not a single thing. I think you have to layer it in kind of across the company. And then just talk about it a lot. So we're, even when we have our failures as a company, we try to be very transparent. We have our, you know, diversity report every year. Mm-hmm. We talk to all Huddlies about kind of where we're at in our journey. And it's not about pointing fingers or saying we're good or bad. It's just about transparency. And I think that facilitates some really nice conversations on where we're at in the journey too, for as a company and individuals.
You know, that in that journey is not a straight line, is it?
It's, oh, gosh, no. Gosh, no.
No, it's not. It's, you know, you take a couple steps forward and a couple steps back and a couple steps forward. And that's been my experience.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
The commitment you talked about from a leadership standpoint, you have to have that commitment there. And I know that even just starting that conversation was difficult, because mm-hmm. we weren't used to talking that way with each other.
Yeah.
And but the commitment to grow that is so important.
And you have to walk the walk. You know, I think there's a lot of companies out there that it's easy to make press releases and make statements, and they don't actually have any meat behind it. Mm-hmm. But to your point, this is a long journey, and it ebbs and flows, and you're going to have successes, and you're going to have lots of failures. And so if you're not in it for the long haul, then it's just gonna be talk. It's right. Not actually going to change anything. And again, I really do believe it's the right thing for the business. You know, fundamentally, it's a good for employees, and it's a good business decision at the end of the day. And so we do truly believe it.
Yeah, I agree. So Huddle has a set of actionable values that drive you as an organization. One I found of particular interest was creating disruptive experiences. You talked about that, you know, mm-hmm. accepting failure. We push ourselves out of comfort zones to interrupt our usual patterns, think globally, and uncover unconscious biases. We inevitably make mistakes, but we learn and grow from them. So what's some of the takeaways from that, Brian? What specific measures does Huddle take to ensure that mistakes are viewed as learning opportunities rather than setbacks? And how do you personally apply similar measures in your own life to embrace mistakes as avenue for growth? That's the second part is a tough one.
It is a really tough one. This is one of those things that we talk about all the time as a company. But it's really hard to actually pull off in reality, because no one likes to make mistakes. No one likes to fail. No one likes to mess up. And, you know, you need to be able to actively learn from them and get better without and have accountability, but not point fingers and encourage mistakes. So there's a set of fine lines there that are really mm-hmm. difficult. And so we do a lot of things to try to foster that kind of from the ground level up. We really embrace as an engineering team and a product team, Scrum, and a big part of that is both the planning and the retrospective. Mm-hmm. So every sprint we do a retrospective for each individual squad. We look at what went right, what went wrong. You try to take a dispassionate view of it. I think that's really helpful. So even if an individual messed up, it's not about that. It's about, this is what went wrong, this is the action we take, this is how we're mitigating. And I think that allows you that kind of dispassionate view mm-hmm. allows you to better analyze those mistakes and learn from them. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things we do as a company is we try to very openly acknowledge risk so that people are comfortable with it. So if we're going into an area, like we've launched a new product recently in the ticketing space, and it's a new area for us, and it's a high-risk area. We've never done it before. Mm-hmm. It's a new muscle on sales. It's a new muscle on engineering. And so we talk about that a lot, that this is a high-risk area. What does that mean? What does success look like? What does failure look like? And so people know that there might be some failures here. And we, as a leadership team, we acknowledge that. And I think so just having that kind of risk-based approach and really meaning it certainly helps. And maybe the last thing we do as a leadership team is we try to run corporate experiments. Mm. They're called corporate experiments, and we talk about it. And that means we're very much acknowledging this might fail. And we talk about that a lot. We were doing things like, we call it Core Week, which is we encourage people to come into the offices for a certain week every month to try to get some density of people in kind of our hybrid environment. That's an experiment. It has a start and an end date. We track metrics around it. We look at occupancy. We look at NPS score of employees. We publish that to everyone. And that experiment might fail. And we're like, but you just don't know if you don't try it. And so we really encourage this concept of risk and experimentation and then transparency around what's happening. And then you don't end up pointing fingers or blame because everyone's mm-hmm. kind of in the boat together on it.
Yeah, I love that approach. Yeah. Do you ever use scenarios or think as you're working through the risk, think about the different scenarios so you build that muscle as well?
We do. We do a lot of like design reviews, and we call them in our world, it'd be like bet reviews.
Okay.
So you make a bet on something and you lay out possible scenarios and options. You go through and analyze each one, and then you pick one with known risks assigned to it and sure. known timelines, mm-hmm. and then you proceed. And you can always pivot later, but it's a very like conscious decision around mm-hmm. that. So we internally, we don't call them scenarios, but I think it functions the same way.
Yeah. We've used scenarios over the years, and it's like building the, we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but we want to build that skill to try to hedge our bet against yeah. multiple outcomes. So.
yeah, and sometimes you have to parallelize. Yeah. And if you have your two parallel paths to the same outcome, one is going to fail.
Right.
You're only going to pick one. But as long as everyone knows that and it's not seen as a failure, it's seen as just, you know, this is how we're hedging our risk. Mm-hmm. And both are successful in the fact that they proved one is the correct path.
Right.
I think it leads to good outcomes.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I've observed in your commitment to inclusive leadership that extends far beyond the executive suite that you talked about is it must be ingrained in your DNA and influence everything you do to have that kind of commitment. And in your 2023 inclusion report, I noticed some goals the company is set to accomplish by 2025. Really aggressive, I think.
Yes.
But well done that you'll have employee and racial ethnic diversity index at least 45%. And overall, your index increased from 24.6% in 2021 to 25.9% in 2022. It's remarkable to see how individuals at every level in Huddle also actively embrace and abide these principles. You talked about you're putting in onboarding and mm-hmm. interview processes and just bringing that all the way down through the organization. I think you have to have that inclusive mindset. And we talked about it. It's not just rhetoric. It's a fundamental aspect of how we drive your identity and your collective growth. So can you elaborate a little bit on the strategies Huddle is employing to increase the employee racial and ethnic diversity index to that 45%?
Yeah. A couple of, well, it's not funny, but interesting things about this is we're actually this year having to pivot away from that. And the reason why is nothing to do with the number or the motivation behind it or how we feel about it. It's we can't track that number internationally. So that's based on U.S. Census data, and some of our biggest growth, actually our biggest growth has been outside the U.S. in terms of offices and employees. And it's just too big of a blind spot for us where we're not able to actually look at where we're trending. You look at the 29% number, that doesn't take into account over half our employees.
Wow. Okay.
Because we don't have that data. We're not allowed to have that data on them in most European countries. Whereas I think we're actually doing quite well in terms of our, I'll call it, quote, actual diversity index in Europe, mm-hmm. we're not able to quantitatively track it, which is a shame, honestly. I understand why, for privacy reasons, that's mm-hmm. done, but for a company that's trying to grow and analyze ourselves in that way, it's made it really, really difficult for us to use that as our metric. So we're actually pivoting, but the concepts are the same. So we're looking at, you know, what are the aspects where we need to be reflective of our customers? And it is still, it's gender, it's race, it's socioeconomic mm-hmm. background. Age, you know, it is academic level. And so we are still tracking these to the best of our ability. International is a little tricky sometimes. Mm-hmm. And try to look at our growth in those various areas and set goals for ourselves. And I do think the ways we do that is the same as diversity index or the way we're doing it now. And it starts with transparency of data and looking at the unconscious biases of different stages of your pipeline, whether it's hiring, the top of the hiring funnel, to you know, pay increases and pay transparency, mm-hmm. To manager and interviews, like this whole every step you kind of need to expose that out transparently, mm-hmm. and then try to find those unconscious bias the best you can, and then mitigate them. And so for us, you know, it does start with the interview process and the job pipeline, and so we really try to pay attention to that at the top of the pipeline, and make sure you fill your funnel with the diverse set of candidates. We don't have quotas on who actually gets hired, but we do want to make sure that our pipeline reflects where we're headed as a company and our customers. And we spend a lot of time thinking about that and making sure that we're tracking that across the different roles.
How many different countries are you in?
Oh my gosh, geez. We have full-time employees in probably at least 20 countries. And we have offices, I think, in 14, like actual offices in like 14 countries. And so it does, which is one of my favorite parts about Huddle, to be clear. I absolutely love it, but it makes things like this really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, each one of those countries has a different culture. Each one of those communities has a different culture.
Yes.
So incorporating all of that into your thought process and how you approach work in each one of those has to be different.
It is. And again, it's probably one of my favorite things, but it's also one of the most challenging is, you know, we run a company that wants to have a culture around Huddle and a Huddle culture. But the reality is that's just not how it goes. You have your Huddle culture, and then you have very important parts of your subculture in each country based on their experiences and their nationality and how they operate as a country and as a people in that country. And then you have other subcultures around acquisitions. So you acquire a company, they still have a strong identity of their previous company. And you should embrace that and support that. They should be proud of that. So you kind of want to blend all three of these aspects together and have a strong company culture, but still that pride in your local culture. And that's really hard. And it leads to things like practices around communication and pay transparency and maternity, paternity leave and holidays, work-life balance. Different cultures have different philosophies around when they work during a day and how much and what it means to work on weekends and emergency situations. And so we really do try to be very aware of that and cognizant. And it's important to have strong leaders in each country that can help us navigate that. And then very open and transparent communication. Because we make mistakes. Our number one value as a company is play to win, which means if we're going to enter a space, we're going to play to win that. That value used to be dominate. And the subtext was the same. It was, if we're going to do something, we're going to do it our absolute best. We're going to go 100% into it. We're not going to enter a space that we can't win. And we found that really resonated with employees. Well, when we started having more employees in Europe, we heard that that has a very negative connotation in European culture. And it's seen as a very masculine word. And it was not resonating with our employees there. The intent behind it did resonate. Everyone was bought in on that, like the subtext of the value, but the word itself did not fit the culture of several countries. So we switched it. And that was a very hard thing for us because that was ingrained in our culture for 14 years as a company. But it was the right thing to do because it really helped us bring together all these subcultures around the world and rally around what we were trying to do with that corporate value, which is play to win. So those are some of the examples of ways that we've had to adapt globally to kind of accomplish this.
And words matter, and words are different in different cultures.
They very much so.
Yeah, mean different things. So good for you guys for listening to that. And I could see where the dominate would not be.
I see it now, but that was clearly not the intent. And it's something we had it for many, many years. And then I give a lot of credit to our employees. I have to imagine that it was kind of hard for people to raise their hand to executives and say, I don't like your number one company value.
Right.
That's not the easiest thing to say, but our employees raised that to us and we had a great discussions around it. And then we were able to navigate to a better outcome. Yeah. And we're really, really happy with where it ended up. But it took a lot of guts.
Yeah, I love that approach. And for your team members must have felt safe enough to do that. So that speaks to your culture as well.
I appreciate that.
As the integration of artificial intelligence continues to reshape industries, businesses are mapping out how to strategically incorporate AI into their workflows. This evolution not only impacts operations, but also fundamentally influences the experiences and roles of individuals within each organization. How are you at Huddle navigating the integration of AI into your business workflows, and what considerations are you making regarding its effect on people within your organization? I'm sure you've used AI for a long time.
We have, This has been a part of, in kind of a product side for a long, long time. We're fundamentally, video analytics is core to what we do, and using AI and machine learning to help analyze video is also therefore core. So I'll just give you one easy example. Last year, we did deep analytics in over 2 million sporting events.
Wow.
Over a million of those, we used machine learning to analyze some portion of that sporting event. So it is deeply ingrained at very high volume into what we're doing. Everything from, you can imagine, tracking and jersey recognition to action and event recognition to understanding substitutions to, we use machine learning to drive virtual cameras that film events. It's very, very core on the product side to what we do. And that's only going to keep growing. The operations side is newer, as I think it is for all of us.
Right.
And it's equally exciting. So it's how do we help our customers? How do we help our internal teams be more efficient and expose knowledge quicker? So some of the obvious things are things like chatbots. Mm-hmm. You know, helping our customers ask natural language questions and get answers quicker and more efficiently and to the point. And we have a lot of usage there. It's how do we help our users even navigate the product? So we've seen, you know, customers like an English Premier League club might have a huge library of video. How do you get to the moment that matters? You know, AI is a really great way to do that, honestly. You can speak to it. I want to find, you know, all the moments in the soccer match where we're in the attacking third and we had a cross followed by a missed shot in our last three matches.
Wow.
Well, you should be able to ask that question verbally, and we can pull all that out. And we can actually find those moments using machine learning and artificial intelligence. And so I just think it's changing so quickly. It's really exciting. I think for us as a company, we try really hard to be on the leading edge, but not necessarily the bleeding edge. I think one of the risks that companies have is there's so much innovation happening so quickly. Mm-hmm. We'd like to give it just a small amount of time. We're talking months, not years, for things to settle before we move into that space so you don't go off on a crazy tangent and down the wrong path.
Right.
And so that's kind of been our corporate philosophy, is a very fast mover, but not necessarily always a first mover into these spaces. Kind of see what's going to be successful and try to be positioned from a talent point of view to move mm-hmm. fast into it. Mm-hmm. Make sure our teams are well-educated, know the research, know the philosophies behind it, we can really quickly adopt it internally. Mm-hmm.
I think that's, because I know that the work that you're doing, as you mentioned, you've been doing this for a long time, so it probably feels less foreign to you than maybe some firms that, like our civil engineering and planning and landscape architecture, it's not ingrained in, I mean, we use AI on various things, but it's not as ingrained in our day-to-day work as what you're doing, so.
And I got to imagine for you all that it's, there's an interesting aspect where a lot of AI is almost like black box. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know how it's operating internally. And so as an engineering company, not being able to actually, you know, prove the chain of calculations and controls that go into place is an interesting set of challenges. And so for the creative aspects, it's probably a little more inspiring, a little easier to imagine.
Yes,
for the engineering aspects, it's a little bit different ballgame. Like I can imagine how difficult that would be.
We're talking about having that human in the middle. Start with AI, human in the middle, maybe carry it on, but making sure that black box, that we know what's going on in the black box, so that we don't, because there is risk. There's risk to what we build and making sure that what we know what's happening and what that impact might be. So,
yes.
Well, this has been delightful, Brian. Thank you so much for coming in and taking time to spend with us today. And that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in to the Legacy Listening Podcast with your host, Nancy Predahl. I'd like to once again thank our guest, Brian Kaiser, for joining us. It was a pleasure and honor to have you with us. And to our listeners, we hope you enjoyed today's episode. Like, share, and download all of our past episodes on Apple, Spotify, or our website. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.